Okay, thank you all for joining us today. This concurrent session is 7C. I've noticed all the chairmen give that number to the session, so I'm not sure if that's helpful, but we appreciate that you have a choice in your concurrent sessions, and so we do thank you for choosing deferred annuities today. This one is titled Deferred Annuities, What Exactly Do They Look Like? Now, we're assuming that we don't need to tell you that a deferred annuity is an income stream that commences after a period of deferral and continues for life. It's meant to be a little bit more in-depth than that. What will happen today is that there has been quite a few changes in this space of late, particularly with different initiatives that have been announced in budgets and things. So Tony will provide an update on some of the recent changes that have occurred in the income stream space, particularly around deferred income streams. Darren will provide a bit of an update on the potential role and what that might look like in a post-SIPA world. And Lee will explore some of the key design questions that exist from a product and delivery perspective. There'll be plenty of time for questions at the end, as is customary, so do keep an eye on what's being said throughout the conversation and store up your best questions. By way of a brief introduction, Tony, I'll just introduce all the speakers and then we'll just run through the material and conversation so that the introductions don't get in the way as we go. So Tony, until recently, was the CFO at Challenger and also the appointed actuary. He's currently transitioning to a new role of Chief Risk Officer for Challenger, which he commences in July. So he has extensive experience in life industry prior to joining Challenger as well in actuarial and management roles. So we'll look forward to Tony's insights. Darren, who will speak second, is General Manager, Group Life, Product and Pricing, as well as Investments and Retirement Incomes at TEL. In his spare time, he's also a trustee director of the Mercer Super Trust and some of the other Mercer entities, and is a member of the Institute's Retirement Income Strategy Group. And I know Darren from working with him years ago, so has worked a lot in the retirement income space, so also well qualified to speak to us today. And Lee is head of actuarial superannuation investments at Cominsure, which has responsibilities around annuities as well as traditional PAR and unit-linked business. So Lee also has a strong retirement products focus and experience and a keen interest in developing longevity solutions for the future, as well as over 25 years life experience in South Africa and Australia. So a wide variety of experience that we can draw on today, so we'll look forward to everyone's insights. You didn't come to hear me, so to get the ball rolling, we'll introduce and welcome Tony to the floor. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, everybody. So this will be something of a gallop through some of the changes. I've only got four slides, so that tells you the level of detail we're going into. But if we went back a few years, there are a number of historical or a number of impediments identified to deferred lifetime annuities. So effectively, the first was the SIS definition around a superannuation pension didn't include deferred annuities. They had to be immediately payable. What that then meant was that a life company couldn't hold the annuity or the deferred annuity in its SEA, and therefore it wasn't zero taxed. So there were a lot of sort of tax implications of that. Second one, which impacted ordinary money annuities, is the earnings tax treatment during deferral, both from a life company point of view and also from the impact on the individual, so the individual having to pay tax on the accrual of the deferred annuity even though they're not receiving any payments, and that's to do with the definition of a lifetime annuity rather than a superannuation pension. The minimum surrender value standard as issued by APRA treated a deferred annuity as an investment product during the deferral period, effectively meant you did not get to use mortality credits as part of the deferred annuity. Means testing treatment was unknown, just wasn't defined at all, and then minimum drawdown rules obviously got in the way of deferred annuities because there were no drawdowns during the deferral period. So there's been a number of changes going on, and so where do we live now? The SIS definition of a superannuation pension has been changed, and I'll go through that in a little more detail next. So we'll call that one a green now, that you can issue a deferred annuity. The earnings tax treatment during the deferral period for lifetime annuities, so this is ordinary money, still exists. The problem still exists. So if you want to say what exactly will they look like, so we know for the time being they must be superannuation money. You can't, well, you can't with any kind of economically attractive returns issue an ordinary money deferred annuity. The minimum surrender value standard as issued by APRA has been updated to remove the relevant section. So now if you want to issue a deferred annuity, you have to go to APRA and get their approval for what the minimum surrender value will be. So I've called that amber because it doesn't quite provide total clarity, but at least it gives you a route to an answer. The means testing treatment came out in the budget, so I've rated that as red trending to green. The reason for doing that is partly, obviously, it's only been announced in the budget. It is not yet legislated. And also, it's still only meant to commence 1st of July next year. So for the next year, we still don't have means testing treatment attached to deferred annuities. And the minimum drawdown rules were also sorted out by the innovative superannuation income stream rules. So just to cover what those look like. So these commenced 1st of July last year, effectively redefines or adds an additional definition to what constitutes a superannuation pension. And so what it means is that provided you satisfy this capital depletion or capital drawdown schedule, then you can have a deferred annuity. So what does that mean? So somebody, to get a payment, somebody still has to satisfy a condition of release. They can have a deferred start period. Once that deferred start period has occurred, it needs to be regularly paying and have a no unreasonable deferral of income, which is an interesting contrast that you can't. You can have a deferred period for, you know, undefined as long as you like, but then once you actually start, you can't have any more significant deferral in the income thereafter. It's subject to this declining access schedule, which effectively says that you can have this surrender value equal to a linear reduction from purchase price to zero at life expectancy. Life expectancy for this purpose is sort of the life expectancy that we're used to in these sorts of things, being the Australian Life Table's life expectancy with no mortality improvement allowances, so shorter than what we would actually consider to be real life expectancy, although it is somewhat complicated as well by the regulations defining a year as being 365 days. So that means if there's any leap years during a person's life expectancy, which I suppose we would assume there would be, you actually end up losing a year. So for sake of argument, a male age 65 has got a life expectancy of 19.22 years. You need to round that down to 19 to start with, and then say, well, actually, it's 19 times 365 days, which means you're actually at 18 years, 360 days, or thereabouts. So if you want to have a whole number of years of deferral, you're actually at 18 years as a maximum deferral period. So it's a little bit messy, but such is the world of regulations. You can also have a death benefit of 100% of the purchase price up to life expectancy on two, which is similarly very clearly defined. So that's all I'm going to say on innovative superannuation income streams. We've recently had the budget announcement of the means testing treatment of pooled lifetime income streams, which includes deferred lifetime annuities. So effectively, there is a flat payment, a flat percentage of income is included in the income test for a deferred annuity. That means that there is no income test during the deferral period. There is, however, an asset test. That asset test is 60% of the purchase price until age 84 or 5 years from purchase, whichever is the later, and then it drops down to 30%. In general, we would see that if all you invested in was an annuity, the income test would be the test that would be active, at least for immediate lifetime annuities. However, if you mix it up, as people are probably likely to do, with an allocated pension or something else, so only a portion of the income, only a portion of the investment goes into an annuity, then probably the asset test will be the active test because it is based on the whole of your investment. And that's what I'm covering. I shall pass it on. Who's next? Is it Lou?
Who's going from there? Rightio, this is the closest we're going to get to answering the question in the title of the presentation. What exactly does a deferred lifetime annuity look like? So what I've got there is a basic deferred lifetime annuity that fits the mould that Tony's just described there. So what I want to really do is look a bit under the hood and see how you might use it in real-life solutions. So basically that one, you can see what it's got is a initial investment at some time. You've got a guaranteed death withdrawal benefit for a period up to life expectancy. So it fits all those tax rules. And then you've got a payment starting at a certain time, and that can be fixed or can be indexed to CPI or other indexation from a certain period. Right, so that's the basic picture we've all got together. Just to compare that to other products that are out there already, we've got lifetime annuities. That's a straight, pure lifetime annuity. That one's flat income for life with return of capital, and you can see those layers of capital, repayment of principal, interest, and mortality credits building up over time. So what I want to do is just flick between these quickly, and you can see basically what the deferred lifetime annuity does is basically boost those payments from that date. So you've got the benefit of mortality credits and interest yield on the annuity. In those early years, that boosts the payments up, and you've got those bigger mortality credits coming through later. So that's the basic picture we've all got on that one. So now let's bring it to real life. So when you're looking at retirement and the considerations that people have got and what are they trying to achieve, there's a lot of these different things that no one product can meet all of these things. That no one product we've currently got. I see there's a session next up where we're going to be, there's a suggestion around products that address changing needs through retirement. But that's really the thing. You've got different life stages. You've got different requirements there. So people are looking for, if you ask people what they want all the things that annuities offer, but they also want access to capital, more access to capital than perhaps annuities offer. They need the longevity protection. They need income security. There's issues around inflation, addressing inflation risk. And people have perhaps inheritance and legacy, leaving a legacy behind, the security of their capital and their investments, and the need for that liquidity. So those are some of the real life issues that we're probably all familiar with and that no one product can really meet. But if you start to look at a strategy that might deal with that, this is the first look at it. It's quite a simple strategy where you've got a 400,000 super balance at retirement at 67, and this is a basic layering strategy where we purchase a deferred annuity. You live off the income from your allocated pension in those first years, together with the age pension. That gives you something around about $40,000 per annum, which is the ASFA. It's a bit below that. I think it's a bit higher than that now, but around about $40,000 per annum until that runs out at life expectancy, and then you've got the deferred annuity kicking in as you enter the passive retirement stage. So that's a pretty easy strategy where you're putting about 15% of your retirement proceeds into that deferred lifetime annuity. That's $65,000 is giving you about around about $10,000 from the age of 79. So that's a basic way that you can start to layer these products up. So if you look at another, take those three basic products that we've got there, the account-based pension, the immediate lifetime annuity, and the deferred lifetime annuity, one way of looking at the benefits from that is to look at the cumulative benefit over the lifetime of the product or over the total lifetime. So what we've got there is, if you look at those yellow bars, that's basically they're increasing each year as the cumulative income increases. So while you've got an increasing bar, you've got an increasing income. So if you take the top, the account-based pension, it obviously runs out at some point. Well, that's all you ever get, right? In the meantime, though, you do have that access to capital. So none of these are to scale, but it's just the but you've got a fairly good access to capital there, but that, yeah, it runs out when the account runs out. The immediate lifetime annuity, you've got less access to capital, but you have got the lifetime income profile there, and so an increasing benefit throughout the lifetime of the product. So with a deferred lifetime annuity, you've got that adjusted pattern where you've got the, again, limited access in the initial years, but a more accentuated or boosted income boost in the later years. So putting all those three together, you can start to see, well, could we come up with a better solution than any one of those by itself? So that's a very simple jamming three things together, 70%, 20, and 10. And you can see there that it might, there's a hope that that can start to address some of, more than just one of those issues, because you've got good access to capital there in the early years. You've got an income throughout, a guaranteed income throughout life that's going right through to the end of lifetime there. So that's just a simple example. In reality, you can build up pretty complex strategies from just using those simple products. In this one, we've done a picture there of using it. There's also a term annuity in there in the beginning, so people have been talking about delayed purchase of lifetime annuities and using layering strategies around that, so where you don't commit all your capital at once into different investments, but hold them back. So one, you put some of that aside in a term annuity that matures a few years later. So in that one, we've got a term annuity. You've got the age pension building up at the bottom there. You've got the allocated account-based pension. The term pension's going into an immediate life annuity at some point. That's the blue bars going in, and then somebody's got a deferred life annuity there as well. So that's boosted the income in the later years. But you can see that there's kind of a range of possibilities that you can do here. I mean, that's the one solution for quite a particular one, but there's quite a bit of optimizing that could be done here and working around what are people's priorities, balancing some of those and putting them together in different ways, just using those three basic building blocks. You can come up with quite a variety of different outcomes. So given that at where we stand today, there's no one product that's going to meet all of those requirements, I think you can see that there is a hope that using all three together, though, there's a chance of getting to a position where you're meeting at least a lot more of those needs that people have. Yep, so that's me. Darren, do you want to take it from there?
Seems to be out there.
Okay. I may not have any slides.
I think you click on the name.
Ah, okay. Tension is mounting. Okay. Yay, we got to the end. So, look, thank you, Lee. I'm going to preface what I'm about to say with a huge disclaimer. So, unlike Lee and Tony that work for companies that have on-sale annuity products, I don't. We did have an on-sale annuity product 15 years ago. So me giving advice on deferred annuities is a little bit like me being an authority on romantic dating, even though I've been married for 20 years. So, although I would say if the opportunity is tempting enough, I will re-enter the market. and that is the annuity market, not the dating market, of course. But today I am going to talk about SIPPers, and in particular I'm going to drill down on the recently released position paper on SIPPers, because I do think it is very relevant for deferred annuities, and certainly part three, principle three, is the most relevant, which is what is the definition of a SIPPer. And the main components are there, the three elements, and I'll go through each of those three elements of the definition. But a key point is that 100% allocation to an account-based pension does not meet the definition of a SIPPer. So there is going to be a longevity component. So the first point is that the expected income should be broadly consistent. So at the outset of the design of a SIPPer, it should be expected that the income ranges within a narrow band, and the suggestion here was plus or minus 2.5% of that first year income. Now, it's important to note that that is the expectation at the outset. If the actual outcome is different, that's okay. But I think the intent was around the design in the first place. Now, importantly, in that position paper, in discussing what that might look like, it gave the example of an account-based pension and a deferred life annuity, which I think in some of the Treasury papers has been referred to as the cut strategy. But importantly, and just another design element, trustees will have the discretion as to whether or not to consider the impact of the age pension in the design of the SIPPer. The next element, as we talked about before, is it must provide an income for life. So importantly, and very clearly says, it's not just about life expectancy. And it gives the example, even if you live to 105, you should expect an income. It does discuss a range of pooled lifetime products being used. Now, that could either be an immediate annuity or a deferred. It didn't limit it to those, but a pooled product. It could be group self-annuitisation, or it could be an insured guaranteed lifetime annuity. And interestingly, it's suggested that for a SIPPer, around 15 to 20% of the account balance at retirement is allocated to these pooled products. The final design element of the SIPPer was having some flexibility around access to capital. So the most common way to provide access to capital, it's suggested, is to have an element of an account-based pension. But once again, that's a trustee discretion. Now, that's important for the design of the SIPPer, because if you allocated it all to an immediate annuity, you wouldn't have that access to capital, so there does need to be some balance. If it was a strategy that had an account-based pension then a deferred annuity, then they might not have access to capital in later years. So what I'd like to talk about now is just some reflections around those design principles and how they might be put into practice, and some of the things that trustees might consider when building a SIPPer, and in particular whether or not to use a deferred annuity or an immediate annuity. And I should say there, and want to acknowledge, there are other approaches. And David David Orford and David Rush have both written papers on alternative approaches to longevity. And I know also Michael Rice has written around dollar cost averaging lifetime annuities as you get older. But today I'm just going to focus on, if you're a trustee, how would you make the decision? And there's a few things that trustees will need to consider. And the very first one, I think, is how do the various combination of products model? What are the actual outcomes for members? And certainly these new social security rules that have been announced will take a bit of time to digest and model. The pricing of the different products will be important. And I think it's important to note that for immediate and lifetime annuities and deferred annuities have different capital intensities and different longevity and asset risks at different parts of the spectrum, which might affect the cost. In coming up with the design, funds, in my experience, are most interested in keeping as much of the assets as they possibly can. I mentioned having capital access earlier in your retirement compared to later, and there's different needs. Earlier in your retirement, you might want to be travelling or helping the kids with their deposit on the home. Later, it's more about health costs. And I think these last three are actually quite important, the complexity. I quietly suspect most people don't understand superannuation at all. They don't understand retirement income products. They don't understand account-based pensions, let alone annuities or group self-annuitisation. So I think simplicity in the communication is going to be really important. And an interesting debate is, are pooled products an investment or are they insurance? Are they longevity insurance? And also the perception of value. If you're going to say to somebody, well, you're going to have a deferred annuity that starts at 85, most people think they're going to not last that long. They'll last until 82. Why would I bother putting any of my money into a deferred annuity? So that is a constant challenge, I think, that trustees and providers will have. Last year, Deloitte published their forecast, and it indicated that each year around 60 billion transitions from the accumulation phase to the retirement phase. So that's a lot of money each year, and it's going to grow to 230 billion in the year to 2030. So just a bit of a thought experiment. If you allocated 15 to 20% of that to a pooled product, where currently only less than 1.5% is being allocated to pooled long-term products, then in 10 years' time, there'd be around 200 billion of liabilities in these pooled products. Now, whether that's a GSA or an insured annuity, that's a big number. Now, even if there was a 25% take-up rate of SIPPers, and they do require consent, that's still 50 billion in liabilities. And to place that in context, currently the life insurance industry today, if you take away unit-linked, has only around about $100 billion in liabilities. So that represents a substantial increase in at-risk liabilities in the system. And I'll just briefly deviate into some reflections on GSA, because this session is about deferred annuities, but it may well equally apply to deferred GSAs. I think actuarial control is likely to be required, particularly if the liabilities are in the order of 25, 50 billion. And for me, they're actually almost the same as a participating product in a life insurance company. And the same issues of monitoring and solvency, equity, and policyholder reasonable expectations arise. So I think that will give rise to if there's GSAs within funds, the need for an appointed actuary within a superannuation fund.
Okay, thank you all. So that's a quick tour through the landscape of deferred annuities and deferred longevity products generally and the opportunities that they present. I certainly learned something out of that, which is that deferred annuities are something like romantic dating. So if that isn't an attractive proposition for you all, I really don't know what is, but maybe it's the $50 billion of liabilities. So we'll open with some questions. Would anyone like to jump in with some questions? This is a significant opportunity. If not, I will ask one. It could be Lee or maybe Tony on this one. One of the things, and I saw Nicolette walk in the room somewhere, so I was sort of channeling a comment that Nicolette made a while ago. One of the things with deferred annuities from a design point of view is that maybe all the money doesn't need to be put in up front, and that maybe the idea of paying by some kind of annual premium or annual instalment through the deferral period would be considered perhaps an attractive proposition. So I guess the question I've had in that is, have you had a look at, do the mortality credits flow through as strongly in that proposition? Have you had a look at that? And, you know, is that an option that you'd sort of think about? Either can...
Okay. Yeah.
So I think quite simply the answer is yes, that is a product that could potentially work. Clearly there are fewer mortality credits that arise, so you know, on average, rather than being over 25 years, say, it's over 12 or 13, but you know, you would still get some significant mortality credits coming through. It would create a few design challenges, or design questions at least. One version of a product would be where you say it is a true sort of regular premium product, where you say you make these payments and then I will give you this annuity. Another would be what you might call a recurring single premium product, where each year the person makes a payment and there is at that point, you determine how much extra annuity they've got. So there's some questions about how longevity moves and how interest rates move that would be reflected there. And then you would also need to consider things such as, particularly in the true regular premium one, what happens with if people decide to cease making the payments and therefore you actually wind up needing some sort of paid-up value to be determined.
I'll just probably add that I think there's also a behavioural aspect to this. So people are probably more used to the idea of insurance premiums. And so that if you think of this as longevity insurance, it may be something that's more palatable to people to pay a premium towards that cover that kicks in at that later age. So I don't know if you may have noticed on that one graph I had there, did say or by lump sum or by regular premiums. But it, in that particular, if we are going to give like withdrawal guarantees, like withdrawal and death guarantees, that also eats into mortality credits. So that's just another way that this is probably, I haven't looked at the comparative outcomes, but there are less mortality credits, but in a potential product design where you're offering some sort of access to capital or withdrawal benefits, there's less mortality credits as well. And other thing around the behavioural aspect is it's not always, you know, what we think of from a probably purely technical actuarial view, what's the right answer. Because, yeah, if you're going to buy a product like this, you'd maybe argue, well, the pure style of the product is to maximise the mortality credits. That's why you're doing it. But it's really a lot of behavioural aspects to this that people maybe like to know that if they die within a few years, they get something back. They like to think about, you know, can I pay this off over time to get that cover in 20 years' time?
Okay, Anthony.
Thanks, Guy. Just a question, well, comment on the question. My question is, I don't actually understand why one would want deferred life annuities when you can pack the whole post-retirement thing into one product and produce any set of values, any set of cash flows that you want. I think the point is, there's a paper by Brown and others on framing of the post-retirement income as an investment or as a consumption plan. And the difference in people's response is dramatic. So 20% of the people saw annuities as a good investment. 70% saw it as a good consumption plan. And if that does translate anywhere near into market research, that's how we've got to frame. It's not insurance. It's a consumption plan, what I call it a harvesting plan. How are you going to go about it? And it seems to me that there is this articulation problem. If you have a term annuity for the first portion and then a deferred life annuity for the other portion, is how do you get them to work together? Looks fine initially, but as we know with articulated trucks, as soon as you break, they come apart. And so when things go wrong, it seems to me there are going to be difficulties in making sure that those two tie together in a good way.
Thanks, Anthony. Look, I think that SIPPers will be presented as one package, even though they will have different components. But I like the idea of the consumption plan, and certainly sort of the consumer testing that I've seen, there is a confusion around as an investment and as a longevity insurance. As an investment, it's seen as a very poor investment, particularly if you don't expect to live very long. So I think reframing it away from an investment is useful.
Okay, David had a question. I'll just drop the mic over.
Thanks, Guy. First of all, an ad. So if you want to know more, come along to session 9C this afternoon.
Shameless,
yes. In that, I've actually looked at this question about single premium versus regular premium, and actually I don't think, you do have fewer mortality credits with regular premium, but the difference is not as great as you might think. So regular premium is possibly a way to go. The final thing, there has been some debate in the AASB 17 context about whether annuities are an investment or insurance. I think there's certainly at least an investment component there, but the feeling seems to be that let's just treat them all as insurance, and it makes life simple.
Does that have impacts for financial, maybe Tony? Is that something you've thought about?
Yeah, I suppose first of all, the regular premium side. Yes, I've read David's paper. Funnily enough, my name actually appears in it somewhere. But there's been a number of other papers that contemplate those sorts of things. I think I saw Duncan Rawlinson around somewhere. There's a paper that he and Michelle Cater wrote some years ago that I pull out and point people to with monotonous regularity, because it looks at the comparison of mortality credits versus equity risk premium, and sort of looking at when is an optimal time to buy annuities and so on. So I just find that a very interesting concept. I've forgotten the second point. What was the second?
Insurance
or investment, yes. I think I struggle with thinking about annuities as investments, because investments suggest there is some, you know, specific return that is kind of intrinsic to the investment itself. And with a lifetime annuity, that return, albeit the life company prices it up on some sort of cost of funds concept about what underlying rate they're planning to pay, the outcome of an IRR for the annuitant is just so enormously variable, depending on how long they live, that I just really struggle to look at it with an investment frame. To your point about whether you can consider it to be part of one and potentially part of another, I think if it has significant death and or commutation benefits, then you can probably start to put that in. But a pure lifetime annuity, to me, just because of that sort of IRR variability, you know, and I accept equities have enormous IRR variability as well, but because it's not sort of intrinsic to the product itself, I don't kind of see it as an investment product, but could go either way.
So there's an interesting accounting issue that arises from that for a life company and declaring profits on deferred annuities. So one of the issues with margin on services at the moment is you only declare the profits when the service is being provided. Well, in the deferral phase, what is the service? And do you delay declaring any profits until the deferral period's over? There's ways around it, but the current regime doesn't deal with it easily.
Yeah, a similar problem under AASB 17 with deferred annuities, because they say that the release of the profit or the CSMs that will be under AASB 17 depends on provision of the insurance service. If there is no investment service and the insurance service doesn't start until the end of the deferral period, you don't get any profit until the end of the deferral period. And that might be a problem.
Yeah, I won't claim to be a AASB 17 expert, but I would say that chances are any of these products are going to be in loss recognition on day one.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions down here. So there's a mutual respect society saying you go first. So, yeah.
Duncan Rawlinson, thank you, Tony, for the plug for my paper. It was about, I think, 12 years ago now, maybe 11 years ago, but it's good to see it's still alive and well. David, I'm thrown by that, I've got to say. If we blinker ourselves to think about annuities, that the service being provided is the payment of the annuity, I think we're making a mistake. A lot of discussion here and in other sessions has been these products are all about the pooling and the allocating of mortality credits, survivor risk premium is the term I've used before. Well, there is insurance being enjoyed through the deferred period through the pooling and reallocation of mortality credits. So I think we should keep a very broad view of what the service might be and not kind of box ourselves into silly IFRS 17 outcomes. That would be my view. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take that as a comment. So, David?
I was reading something from the Pension Policy Institute from the UK. Under the old rules, when people got to age 65, they had 10 years in which they had to annuitise. So they had a pot of money and they had 10 years to do it. The experience was that about 70% of them did it in the year after, in age 66, another 20% the year after, another 5% the year after. There were some that actually annuitised down the end of the track. But I always thought the POMs were dumber than us, but they're actually smarter because they're annuitising as soon as they possibly can and they get the benefit of the mortality credits. I guess my question in this context is, what do you think the market will like? Do they really want deferred annuities or do they want immediate annuities? I can understand that the advisory networks that your two life companies operate, the advisors would want to have account-based pensions because that gives them a job into the future. But down the other end of the income stream, for the poorer people in our community, wouldn't it be better for them to have just lifetime income streams from age whenever they retire? So I'm looking at the demand. What's the demand?
Yeah, I think maybe a comment on the UK. Obviously, they had their pension reforms, I don't know, 2015 or thereabouts, which did change those rules. There's a number of ways to think about, you know, deferred annuity versus immediate lifetime annuity. And part of that, I think, comes down to the advice process, that advisors like to go through and do a risk profile on people and put them in their bucket, and then they put an asset allocation bucket or an asset allocation that is associated with that particular risk profile, And if they think about selling annuities, often what they will do is put the annuity off to the side and then say, well, now, having put some of the money across in an annuity over to the side, I'm going to do my risk profile and so on. And I think that's probably another framing mistake, that the annuity is, you know, part of the defensive bucket, effectively, once you do the risk profile. And so if you think about it in that context and you say, well, this is part of my defensive investments, and yes, I get a lower expected return than I do from an equity portfolio, but that's okay because I've got a defensive component, then maybe immediate lifetime annuities work better there. But you're right, there are a whole bunch of other behavioural drivers, particularly access to capital, hyperbolic discounting, you know, all the stuff that people have talked about for a long time, that means that people may struggle putting those sorts of things aside, and therefore a deferred annuity may be less offensive, I suppose, in that context, because you're putting a lesser proportion aside at outset.
Okay, we've probably got time for one more, and John's desperately had his hand up, so we'll give him a run.
Will SIPPers be customisable to meet the circumstances of particular individuals? So by way of an example, I think one of the slides suggested 70% account-based pension, 20% immediate annuity, 10% deferred pension. If somebody wanted to go to 50% account-based pension, 30 immediate annuity and 20 deferred annuity for means testing reasons, is that possible within the SIPPer? And then related question, how will that process work? Because I think people are going to need advice.
Okay, well, because I've got the microphone, I'll start, but I can hand over to others who might be better placed. But my understanding is the super fund will have a SIPPer, which is defined and has defined proportions. And if the person chooses to have different proportions of the same bits and pieces, that will not be the SIPPer. Then the next question is, how do they get to those proportions? And that is potentially, well, they may just make their own decision, but it could be through some advice process, which could be full advice, scaled advice, and the various other options. I don't know, somebody else want to?
Yeah, not much more to add to that. I think it's pretty early days yet, but yeah, as you know, there's the three SIPPer per fund that's allowed, and kind of implies, well, there might be some, you know, ranges of different types of membership where different arrangements would be the one that was offered. So that would, as far as we can see, be the only flexibility that would be in those arrangements.
So with that, just to commend the Treasury Retirement Income Paper to everybody. There is an example in that about what a SIPPer might look like, and on page 8, which talks about how the fund might vary if you just had a straight account-based pension and deferred annuity type SIPPer, how depending on age at retirement you'd obviously change the proportions allocated to those, and how that stays the same SIPPer. And then on page 9 it talks about the process towards how a fund might tailor that more towards individuals if they perhaps instruct the fund about their particular preferences, and how that might interact with intra-fund advice leading through to more complex advice. So I'd commend the paper to you. It does talk through that, and obviously Treasury are keen on everyone's feedback around that, but it does envisage a spectrum, if that's the right word, from SIPPer through to more customised or individualised solutions, and how advice might sit along that equally in its scaled form. Well, I hear the second bell's gone, so I'd just like to thank you all for a great discussion. That was fantastic. Thank you all for your questions, and if you'd like to thank our speakers in the usual manner.